and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bonson, and I am very excited for this week's guest, who is yet another first-time guest joining us on the Capitol Record. Dr. Calvin Beisner is the president, founder, and chief spokesman at the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Cornwall Alliance may sound like a mouthful here, but I'm telling you, this is really aligned with our mission here at Capitol Record. What the Cornwall Alliance is all about, I'm going to let Cal tell you more, but essentially is a think tank, a network devoted to the cause of economic development, of stewardship of the earth, of proper caring for the poor, but doing so with certain theological and moral understandings that do not undermine the other causes that we hold dear. They care about earthly stewardship, but do not believe that the quote-unquote environmental cause has to work against the economic cause. Rather, they view these things as pro-cyclical. I'm really looking forward to talking with Dr. Beisner. I've followed his work for many years. I think that there is phenomenal work being done at the Cornwall Alliance. And I think this cause, when we talk on this podcast a lot about ESG and about the extremism of the modern environmental movement, I think groups like Cornwall represent needed men and women on the wall to fight against this radicalization around the environmental movement of the day. With that said, let me welcome on Dr. Cal Beisner. So with that said, welcome to Capitol Record and yet another first-time guest that I'm so excited to have joining us today. Please welcome Dr. Calvin Beisner, the president, founder of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Welcome to Capitol Record.
Thanks very much, David. It's a privilege to be with you.
Well, I've told everyone a little bit in the introduction about your story, and yet I do want listeners to kind of get a feel for what you're doing. I love having theologians on Capitol Record. I think that there is a passion that we have in this podcast in how we juxtapose and synthesize our beliefs about a free and virtuous society with the very premise of faith and virtue and so forth. You're doing something that is even more particular in the arena of stewardship, care for the earth. I would love for you to maybe just at a high level introduce what Cornwall does for the audience and maybe explain a bit as to how this became a subject that you're passionate about.
Sure. The quickest and easiest way to put it is what my wife came up with a few years ago. We're trying to save the planet from the people who are trying to save the planet. What that stems from is the fact that so much of the environmentalist movement really works with pretty poor science and pretty poor economics and consequently has policy preferences that don't do much good for the natural environment, but are often very harmful to the world's poor. To put it a little more technically and less tongue-in-cheek, we're a network of just under 70 evangelical Christian scholars. About a third of us are natural scientists, including, by the way, some of the world's top climate scientists. About a third are economists or policy wonks, focusing most of them on either environmental or developmental economics. And about a third are, like myself, theologians, philosophers, ethicists, and ministry leaders. And our aim is to educate the public and policymakers on three things simultaneously and intertwined: what we call biblical earth stewardship, the fulfillment of the mandate in Genesis 1:28 for us to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over everything in it, plus economic development for the very poor. What are the things that are indispensable to lifting and keeping whole societies, not isolated individuals or families, but whole societies out of poverty into prosperity and thriving, material thriving, as well as spiritual thriving. And then the third area is the gospel of Jesus Christ, together with the biblical worldview, theology, and ethics that come right along with that. So our aim is to integrate the insights of scholars in all three of those different areas to figure out how it is that we can best promote simultaneously human thriving and the enhancement of the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and to the benefit of our neighbors, so that we're really addressing the two great commandments, to love God and to love neighbor.
So let's talk a bit more specifics in the need to save the planet from those who are trying to save the planet. When you talk about counterproductive endeavors, what are the things that there's a lot of philosophical and economic critique that we even have done on this podcast against the ESG movement, against a lot of the anti-fossil zealots that all of us get exposed to one time or another. But what are the things that you're referring to constitute counterproductive planetary endeavor?
Yeah, I think we can maybe best move into that by getting at one very basic point, and that is that an awful lot of environmentalists think that economic growth, economic development, is somehow inherently a threat to the environment. I think very, very differently, and so do many other scholars in this field, that actually economic growth, economic development is essential to good environmental stewardship. And the reason for that is really pretty simple. A clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. Well, wealthier people can afford more costly goods than poorer people can. So, you know, just as a pretty common sense way of starting to look at this, ask yourself the question, if you're visiting a city for the first time and you want to find out what are the dirtiest, the least healthy parts of the city to live in, and what are the cleanest, the most healthy parts of the city to live in, well, do you look for the cleanest parts in the poorest parts, or do you look for them in the wealthiest parts? And vice versa, do you look for the dirtiest parts in the wealthiest parts or in the poorest parts? Now, of course, the answer to that is pretty obvious to all of us. The reason for it is not that we assume that poor people don't like a clean, healthful, beautiful environment. It is rather that poor people can't afford a clean, healthful, beautiful environment as well as richer people can. And if we understand
let me jump in there real quick. Do you believe that it is primarily that they can't afford it, or is it that they can't afford it and also can't prioritize it, even apart from their ability to afford what is most needle-moving in creating better environmental condition? Jordan Peterson talks a lot about how it's very hard to think about carbon emission when you have to think about lunch.
Yeah, well,
where you're going to get lunch from becomes a little bit more practical of a priority. Is it both and resources and the just sort of natural prioritization that life conditions necessitate?
Yeah, I think the two go hand in hand. And when I say can't afford, what I mean is I'm not prepared to, as you know, person X, I'm Joe Smith for a moment here. I'm not prepared to spend $1,000 a year on reducing ground level ozone in my city if I'm still having a tough time just putting three solid meals a day on the table for my family. So affordability and prioritization go hand in hand. They're two sides of the same coin, I think. And this leads us to one of the very important insights in environmental economics, and that's what's typically referred to as the environmental transition, or sometimes the environmental Kuznets curve. And that is that historically we see, and this is it's related in part. Restrained in part by the form of government, the political structure in which one lives. But by and large, historically, what we see is that as a society moves from subsistence agriculture to early industrialization, the emission of air pollution and water pollution, toxics, rises. But at the very same time, because the products of that industrialization, including more and therefore more affordable food and clothing and shelter, medical care and the like, do so much to improve human health that human longevity increases, we see this increase in health and longevity at the very same time that we see the increase in pollution. But as societies then move toward a higher stage of industrialization with better technology and as they begin to move toward more of a service information economy, that pollution rises to a peak and then it declines. And it does so at various different levels for various different toxins. And it also is happening earlier and earlier as time goes by because countries that are going through that transition now can take advantage of technologies that were developed by other countries a long time ago. So what this is telling us is, frankly, that growing wealth enables us to adopt the technologies that allow us to produce more food, clothing, shelter, and everything else that we need more and more cleanly and with better and better protection of the surrounding environment.
So what do you think is the resistance to this message from evangelicals? I understand from a more humanistic left-wing standpoint that there's both a theological opposition that's certainly rooted in an opposing philosophy, sort of an antithesis that I'll save for a different conversation. But I wonder your efforts in promoting this message, what opposition you see from fellow believers. Is it the notion that markets simply cannot be tolerated as an acceptable mechanism, that we must marry our stewardship and environmental efforts to an anti-market agenda? Is that something you run into, even in faith circles? Or is it maybe just lack of education and information about the environmental reality? Tell me a little bit about your experience, where opposition comes from.
Yeah, well, the answer to your either or question is yes. it comes from both ways, and it can be helpful to remember a book that Christianity Today several years ago called The Most Influential Evangelical Book of the Last 50 Years. That was Ron Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. And of course, you're familiar with that. It was actually reading that book that first launched me into my interest in economics and particularly economic ethics.
If you don't mind, Cal, I'll interrupt to just let listeners know whether or not you are familiar with Ron Sider. He did very recently pass away.
Yes.
Just within the last couple of weeks. By the time you're hearing this podcast, it will have been about 3 weeks since he passed. And I think he was in his 80s. Mm-hmm. And the book that you reference was first published in the early 1970s.
Yes.
And indeed was quite a big seller. And you're about to say how it was an influence on you. It's certainly a book that I disagree with from head to toe, but it did encapsulate a legitimate argument and a spirit about Christian compassion and social justice that was, from his theological point of view, incompatible with a market economy. So,
yeah, and it's also important to recognize that in later editions, while the first two, maybe three editions of Rich Christians were very heavily socialistic and explicitly, very obviously so, Starting with about the third or fourth edition of Rich Christian's, Ron Sider backed off the socialism quite a lot and recognized increasingly that a capitalist market order was not only more productive than a socialist order, but also better at getting that wealth into the hands of more and more people. And so he really went through, I think, a very laudable transition in his thinking. But when I first read it, it was first edition. And at that time, I had studied a whole lot in theology and biblical hermeneutics, in logic, philosophy undergrad at the University of Southern California. And as I read the book, I thought, gee, I really think that this is misusing scripture in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of the arguments in here are illogical. And if his arguments about economics are as flawed as these are, we could have an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of harm with the very best of intentions, very compassionate intentions. But of course, I didn't know anything at all about economics at the time. So I went out and bought a stack of economics textbooks and read through them. And eventually that led to my doing my master's in economic ethics.
So what were the economic textbooks you were buying at that stage? In the 1970s?
Early 1980s. And David, it would be tough for me to recall which ones specifically. I've read so many
things. Nothing that sticks out.
Yeah, certainly Thomas Sowell was a big help. Gwartney and Stroop, whichever edition of their standard text on economics was around at that point, would have been very helpful. Read a lot by Gary North and others of a more explicitly Christian bent in economics. But I did that, earned my master's in economic ethics in a private tutorial relationship with the late Dr. Russell Kirk, major thinker in the conservative movement. And what I realized was that indeed his understanding of economics was, I think, pretty poor. But Sider's work through his organization, Evangelicals for Social Action, had a profound and very broad influence among many evangelicals who were socially, politically minded. And that played out in the environmental stewardship field because in the early 1990s, when the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, NRPE, was co-founded, by the way, by Carl Sagan of Cosmos fame, you know, the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be, and the dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, a very, very New Age person, James Parks Morton, I think was his name, they co-founded the NRPE with vast amounts of money coming from various liberal left-wing foundations like Rockefeller Brothers Fund and Tides Foundation and the like. They started it with an evangelical branch. They had a Roman Catholic and a Jewish and a mainline Protestant branch as well. The evangelical branch grew out of Evangelicals for Social Action, Sider's organization. So at the very root of this evangelical environmental movement, which launched the Evangelical Environmental Network under the NRPE, you had Sider's sort of thinking. So there was an inherent anti-market bias on the part of many of these people. And unfortunately, that anti-market bias has continued to be the case. It's sort of a presumption that private business will always rape the earth unless it is restrained by government action and government planning. That, I think, is actually the opposite of what history indicates. In pretty much every country in the world, including the United States, the worst environmental disasters are in places that are most fully controlled by government. You look at government scientific research centers. You look at military bases where you have, for example, you know, the testing of weaponry. Those are just a few. But private businesses have incentives to be careful stewards of the environment that governments just don't have, partly because private businesses are vulnerable to tort action, and government isn't that vulnerable. So this is all an issue that I've discussed in a short book that I wrote called Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment?, which is available at Cornwall Alliance's website, cornwallalliance.org/shop, if you want to go right straight to that.
So it seems to me that there are all at once, and I think you're right, that these kind of overlap. There's a lot of both ands going on. But, you know, this subject is near and dear to my heart and at the crux of things I deal with all the time. And particularly in my day job as a very heavy oil and gas investor, particularly in the midstream sector of United States energy, that you're fighting with leftist environmentalists and those in Christian circles and those not, either an ideological war or an informational war or both. And I shouldn't even use the word war because I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but there's a debate that, as you've pointed out, I am absolutely shocked how often one's environmentalism is a veneer for an anti-market ideology and very little to do with environment other than where it can help supplement and overlap with some of the agenda. And the initial draft of AOC's New Green Deal is very enlightening here because there was so much that was put into it that nobody from the left, no true, really zealous, and I would argue, and you would argue, ill-informed, but at least honest environmentalist would have argued that those things were advancing an environmental cause. Things like the economic provision and universal income for people, whether they were able to work or not, which was the language in that draft, were you know, for right or for wrong. And again, obviously, you and I are going to go on to argue that it's wrong. But my point being, it was an argument for the welfare state. It's an argument for a greater role of government in economic administration. It's an argument for more central planning. It's an argument for lack of confidence in free exchange and market actors, all of those things. And I think that argument needs to take place, but it seems unique to me. When we as a society debate gun control, when we as a society debate sanctity of life, when we debate judicial ethics or jurisprudence, we don't normally have to pretend like we're doing something different. We can have the discussion within those confines. We can have differing first principles, or we can have common ones. There can be, you know, agreements, disagreements, what have you. But environmentalism seems to be one of the unique issues of its level of profile, where we are really often having an economic fight that we're pretending is about saving the world.
Yeah. Some of that, David, I think actually probably stems from the very... the very, very basic meaning of the word itself. The word environment stems from a French word meaning to turn around or surroundings. And, you know, hard as I've tried, I haven't been able to figure out anything from the hair on the back of my head to Alpha Centauri that isn't part of my environment. So environmentalism tends automatically to become to encompass everything. It can mean everythingism, or we have another term in the English language that's closely related to that, and that is totalitarianism. If what you're after is preserving the environment, then really you're after preserving all the surroundings that we have. And yet, there's a difference between natural surroundings and man-made surroundings. And there are some surroundings that are really good for us and some surroundings that are not so good for us. And we really need to make distinctions. And unfortunately, a lot of the environmental movement just basically thinks, well, nature is best untouched by human hands. Nature knows best. Back in the 1960s, one environmental writer put it that there were four laws of ecology, one of which was nature knows best. That, of course, you know, you and I as Christians approach this in light of Genesis 1:28, where God tells Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. Well, clearly that indicates that nature doesn't know best, that it is not best untouched by human hands. So we really do come back to this being a matter of worldview and theology in conflict, and we can't ignore that.
I think that's so important, and I agree wholeheartedly. When you are approaching this subject right now, when we get into specific environmental distinctions, I'm just curious, because a lot of times on this podcast, I'm talking to other energy analysts and portfolio managers and folks that are in the space, and there's differences around what people think and don't think about coal versus natty gas versus crude, and where the LNG debate comes in as we think about meeting European needs, apart from Vladimir Putin. Do you have a preference? I'll put my cards on the table so it doesn't seem like I'm tricking you with the question. I'm an all of the above guy, always have been when it comes to energy policy. And so I wonder, though, if you believe when it comes to carbon emission, when it comes to some of the agenda of the day, is natty gas a big focus in how you think about these things for electricity power? Nuclear, do you think we need to have a bigger conversation about America embracing use of nuclear? Or do you tend to avoid some of the particulars and focus more on the theological framework?
That's a great way to put the question. All of the above, I think, is the appropriate answer for anybody, as long as we understand that when we say all of the above, we condition that on the recognition that there are trade-offs for everything, and we need to try to pick for different locations at different times under different circumstances those energy sources, those power technologies that have the best trade-offs. And that means you can't just say one size fits all. And when we're talking about best trade-offs, we have to be talking not only in terms of, you know, what's the cost per kilowatt, the price, the sale price per kilowatt hour of electricity produced, or the sales price of gasoline in the tank, right? It's not just that. It's what are the impacts on the surrounding natural environment? What are the impacts on the surrounding human environment? And we have to really carefully compare various different technologies for that sort of thing. And of course, nowadays, with climate change being the 850-pound gorilla in the environmental discussion, everybody seems to just want to jump instantaneously to carbon dioxide emissions driving a warmer planet, and that's all that they think about. What they're, I think, often not thinking about is, well, there are trade-offs there. As you add CO2 to the atmosphere, since plants use CO2 in photosynthesis, more CO2 yields more plant growth. You can summarize it this way. For every doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. They grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures and wetter and drier soils. They make better use of soil nutrients. Therefore, they expand their range, and all the different creatures that depend on them can expand their range as well. At the same time, they improve their resistance to diseases and pests, and they improve their fruit-to-fiber ratio, which means more food for everything that eats plants or eats something that does eat plants. The people who benefit the most from this are the world's poor, who have the toughest time affording three good meals a day. And so when we look at CO2, we should be looking not only on its effect on global average surface temperature, which, by the way, is pretty minimal when we look, particularly if you put things on a Kelvin scale instead of a Fahrenheit or Celsius scale. And if we go from zero up, You know, we're talking about CO2 making a difference of a small fraction of a percent, rather than looking at it as the, you know, the control knob for global surface temperature. It certainly isn't that, despite the fact that so many people treat it that way. So what this entails is that when we look at low CO2 emission energy technologies and compare them with higher CO2 emission energy technologies, we can't just stop right there and say, well, obviously we choose the low ones, because there are other things that must be taken into account. The cost to those who need the energy, the impact on the natural world, not only about temperature, but also about plant growth, and also, frankly, the amount of mining that needs to be done to provide the rare earth minerals and the metals that are so essential to the making of wind turbines and solar panels. You have to move a whole lot more earth to get those than you do to get the oil, the natural gas, or even the coal to provide the same number of kilowatt hours of power to the grid. So these are just things that unfortunately too many people don't really look at. They don't look at all the trade-offs, and we need to do that.
I think it's fair to ask the question, because how do I want to say this? There's a lot of real unfair rhetoric that, when even though it's unfair, it's incredibly successful and productive mm-hmm. in what they're trying to do. The left will say someone who just says what you said is a climate denier. And I don't believe you are, and I don't believe that's what you said. And I believe any subject that is addressed with the acknowledgement of trade-offs sounds to me like someone doing good economics. I'll plug my book. I wanted to write a book about basic economic truths, and I titled it There's No Free Lunch, because I believe in a lot of ways the allocation of scarcity is a discussion about trade-offs, yes. Particularly for grown-ups. The fact of the matter is that trade-offs cut both ways, and your point is that when we talk about reducing carbon dioxide emissions, there is a trade-off that comes with that. We tend to talk on my side of the fence, and a lot of the right tends to talk about it in the context of what the economic trade-off will be. You're pointing out an environmental trade-off in the plant community and other areas, but do you apply the trade-off principle to the other side that would be the more conventional view that others have about the downside of greater carbon emissions? All things being equal, if we don't discuss for a brief moment the corresponding trade-off that you've so eloquently laid out, do you acknowledge a position that greater carbon emission has had some warming impact in the environment?
Oh, to the very end of your question there, yes, absolutely. I think it's basic physics that as you add infrared absorbing, that is so-called greenhouse gases, to the atmosphere, you're going to absorb more infrared that's moving from the surface back out toward space, and that means you're going to have a warming at the surface level, while you have actually a cooling at the stratospheric level, because not as much heat is getting out there to the stratosphere. That's basic physics. But by the way, basic physics also tells us that if you drop a rock and a feather at the same moment from the same height, they'll hit the ground at the same moment, unless they're in air. And if it's windy, the feather might blow up into a tree and never come down. So reality is a whole lot more complex than basic physics. Now, we have a variety of different climate scientists who volunteer their work with us in various different ways. I mentioned that we have a network of about 70 scholars, roughly a third are natural scientists. And of those, we've got about a dozen climate scientists who've contributed to our work in various different ways. I'll mention just two as examples of our thinking here. One is Dr. Roy Spencer, who is a principal research scientist in climate at the University of Alabama. He's a NASA award winner, and he and his partner, John Christie, handle the NASA global satellite temperature records. And Roy is perfectly happy to say, and he's a good friend, by the way, even sits on my board, Roy is perfectly happy to say, Oh, yeah. Carbon dioxide might have caused more than half, might have caused even all of the increase in global average temperature that we've seen since about 1960. That puts him right in line with the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in terms of what might be the case. Dr. David LeGates, recently retired from teaching climatology for many years at the University of Delaware, has recently joined us as our Director of Research and Education. He and Roy have both been senior fellows for many years with Cornwall Alliance. David thinks that CO2's warming effect is probably significantly less than that, but he doesn't think that it's nothing, and neither do I. There are a variety of different ways of trying to estimate the warming effect of added CO2 in the atmosphere. And, frankly, it's not a matter of one pays one's nickel and takes one's choice, but it certainly is a matter of you can't just simply stand on one of them and say, if anybody disagrees, he obviously knows nothing. No, we're not climate deniers. I don't know what it would be to be a climate denier. We're not global warming deniers. We certainly recognize that we've had significant warming over the last 150 years or so. How much of that is simply coming out of the Little Ice Age? How much of it is due to added CO2 in the atmosphere? That's a matter for legitimate debate.
Do you think that it's important, that it's pragmatically beneficial to our cause to keep that out in front, that it isn't climate denialism? It's more a willingness to engage in reality.
Absolutely.
And accompany this discussion with truth, with trade-offs, with other environmental factors that are relevant. Or do you think that we're going to get labeled a certain way anyways, and so we don't need to worry about it? And I'll tell you why I asked the question, Cal, is I feel as much as possible, I prefer not to give our opponents a weapon. And I think that they're going to be oftentimes guilty of false witness, whether we do or not. And it's the nature of what we live with. At the end of the day, I happen to be an advocate for the sanctity of life. And I accept that some people are going to say that makes me anti-woman. And it isn't true. But, there's certain pejoratives that come with the territory these days. Having nuanced views about stewardship, as you and I do, to a certain degree, I get it comes with the territory that they're going to say that you're a climate denier or whatnot. But I think when it comes to the credibility of advocating for natural gas, not against it, that it is useful to put out that there is an acknowledgement of carbon emission as a factor in what we're talking about. And all things being equal, that I think natural gas is a cleaner burning fuel than coal. And so there's a kind of disarming to some degree that you're going for by enabling these things to be front and center in the conversation. Do you think that I'm being naive here? You think it's unhelpful, unimportant, or do you tend to agree with the kind of approach I'm discussing?
Well, In part, one needs to be a little cautious in that, frankly, where the climate alarmist movement is going is for the goal of the elimination of all use of all fossil fuels. And I think that one of the big mistakes that the natural gas industry has made is posing itself, and I don't mean falsely posing, but taking the position, hey, we result in fewer CO2 emissions than coal does, therefore you should favor us over coal. Well, okay, if CO2 emissions are the criterion by which you're going to make this judgment, sure, you can make that case. But what the natural gas industry has ignored is the fact that, okay, once coal is off the table, oil and natural gas come next. And we need to be fighting against the entire notion that CO2 emissions are going to cause some sort of catastrophe that is far worse than the benefits that we get from them. This is a case that, and I'm not sure if you've had him on your show yet, but Alex Epstein in his book Fossil Future makes this case that, frankly, our use of fossil fuels enables us to master all of the different threats from nature such that, frankly, it really doesn't much matter what sort of climate change arises from our use of fossil fuels. In the future, because of the greater wealth that we get from them, we will be able to master all those changes. And frankly, by the way, that's not a very controversial position among experts in the field. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in its assessment reports, forecasts that regardless which of the various different emission pathways we take over the rest of this century, mankind will be many times better off economically than mankind is today. And that's especially true for the poorest countries in the world. You know, if you have income equivalent even to the bottom fifth of Americans, you can thrive in any climate from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert to the Brazilian rainforest. If you have an income equivalent to only about $2 a day per person, you can't thrive in the best tropical paradise. So when we recognize how much wealth is generated in part by the abundant, affordable, reliable, scalable, dispatchable energy and power, energy being a quantity, power being a flow, a rate, from fossil fuels, even by the IPCC's own projections, we're better off using them than not using them. And that's even before you get into the debates about just how much warming comes and whether the fertilization effect of CO2 offsets the warming effect. And by the way, one other point about the warming. All of the computer models used to estimate the warming tell us that greenhouse warming happens primarily toward the poles, primarily in winter, and primarily at night. That is, it raises low temperatures. It doesn't happen primarily toward the equator in the summer and in the daytime, so it doesn't significantly raise high temperatures. That means that we get fewer cold snaps and less intense cold snaps, and cold snaps on average, kill about 20 times as many people per day as heat waves. So that's all benefit. It also, by the way, increases arable land by making us able to farm closer to the poles, and it increases the growing season as well. You have your last frost earlier in the spring. You have your first frost later in the fall. So you can grow more. So there are all sorts of things that, frankly, are left out of the discussion in the mainstream media and by politicians and by environmental activist organizations.
Well, tell us, as we wrap up here, how people that are as enthralled by what you're doing and what you're talking about can stay connected to your work and sure, be supportive of your endeavors in this vital subject.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, we are at cornwallalliance.org. We also have a Facebook page, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And we have a YouTube channel, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And people can come to our website, cornwallalliance.org, subscribe to our email newsletters that go out a couple of times a week. They're always educational. Certainly, they can donate to us. We are a 501c3 nonprofit religious, educational, and scientific organization. And this month, we're celebrating our 17th birthday, and a number of different donors have pledged to match anything up to $25,000 that we, anything up to $50,000 that we raise for a combined 100. So anything that people donate will be doubled up to that amount. So they can do that just by coming to cornwallalliance.org, click on the donate button, and fill out the form, and throughout the month of August, it'll do us twice the good, and we certainly need it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I hope that you'll come back and join us again on Capitol Record, and we'll keep the information about Cornwall in the show notes and continue to discuss the great work you guys are doing. This is a cause I care about a great deal. Not only for the results we're going for, but the foundation that undergirds it, a shared theological affinity, Cal. I'm really appreciative of the great work you're doing, so thank you.
Thanks so much, David. I would hope to add one other thing, and I mentioned the book Fossil Future by Alex Epstein. For the month of August, we are offering to send a free copy of that as our way of saying thank you when people donate any amount, doesn't matter how much, if they just simply ask for it. And so we'd be glad to do that. And that donation, too, will count toward meeting the matching grants that we've got.
Wonderful, wonderful. Very generous and an absolutely fantastic book. I've read cover to cover, can't get enough of. So thanks so much for joining us here on Capitol Record, Cal.
Thank you, David. God bless.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. There's definitely more for us to pick up on later. I think that they are doing phenomenal work. You got to hear a little bit about the organization at the end there, but also throughout our conversation, you see the truly nuanced approach that they're willing to take. It isn't head in the sand. It isn't radical or contrarian for the sake of being contrarian, but there is a devout commitment to a more holistic understanding of science, of ecology, and also really harmonizing that with what we know about the human person, what we know about economic growth and reality. I am extremely fond of what they're doing. I hope you got a lot out of this conversation. I know I did. And thank you for listening to Capitol Record and supporting what we're doing by rating us, reviewing us, subscribing, and all the things. Have a wonderful week. We'll look forward to being back to you next week for another episode of Capitol Record.